Could the El Faro disaster have been prevented? Rachel Slade will tell us about her new book, Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. How hard is it to adjust to life in America after surviving the Rwandan genocide? Clementine Wamariya will be here to talk about her memoir, The Girl Who Smiled Beads. Plus, our critics Dwight Garner, Carl Sagal, and Jen Salai will join us to talk about the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. I'm Pamela Paul. Rachel Slade joins us now from Brookline, Massachusetts. She is the author of Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Rachel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Pamela.
So this is your first book. Very exciting. A huge positive review from Douglas Preston, a bestselling author, in the Book Review this week. How did you get interested in the subject of El Faro?
The shipwreck story is one of the oldest human dramas in history. And, you know, we've got The Odyssey, Tempest, Moby Dick, Perfect Storm. I mean, this is one of those classic stories. So naturally, when I heard about a modern shipwreck, I was drawn to it. But this story has a uniquely 21st century twist in that we have 26 hours of recordings on the bridge that were captured by that black box. And so now, just like everything in the 20th century, this is the most documented shipwreck in the history of the world.
And does anyone have access to that transcript, or how did you get access?
The transcript is public. Yes, everybody has access. It's 500 pages long.
Wow. So, I mean, it makes for a very different kind of reporting experience, because whereas Sebastian Junger didn't know, just had to kind of speculate and infer what happened during those last hours for the Perfect Storm, you know exactly what happens.
We know exactly what happened on the bridge. The microphones were only on the bridge, so we don't have information about what was happening down below. So, of course, there is a lot of conjecture in that regard. But, yes, exactly. I mean, we know up to the final minutes, the decision-making, the anguish, the fear, the hope of the mariners who were up on that bridge.
All right, let's start with the basic story. What kind of ship was El Faro? Who owned it? What was it doing out there? Where was it in the Caribbean?
So this was a 790-foot container ship. She was 40 years old, which is an important part of the story. And don't forget that 40 years old is very old when it comes to ships and cars and transportation, that sort of thing.
So built in 1974.
That's correct. And actually, she was based on 1960s designs. So the way she was conceptualized was even older than that. But she was doing a regular run between Jacksonville and Puerto Rico, delivering all the stuff of modern life to the island. This was a twice weekly run. The island absolutely depended on this ship and a couple of others to deliver the goods. And if she didn't arrive on time on Friday, October 2nd, 2015, then in just a few days, the shelves in Puerto Rico would be bare. So she was a critical part of the running of the island.
And who owned the ship? What kind of company was it?
Ship owners are kind of fascinating groups, because oftentimes who they are is actually obscured. In this case, the parent company is a privately owned company based on the West Coast called Saltchuk. And under Saltchuk was Tote Maritime, which owned this ship. It's T-O-T-E. That name actually had been inherited from different organizations over time, but ultimately it was owned by Tote. And this part of Tote was based in Jacksonville, Florida.
And where was the crew from?
The crew was an East Coast crew, but what's fascinating is that they spanned from Maine to Florida. We had eight mariners from New England, and the bulk of the unlicensed crew was from Florida, predominantly in the Jacksonville area. And then we had some officers who were also based in Florida. But it's really a Maine, Florida story.
And when you say unlicensed crew, what does that mean?
So if you go to a maritime academy, you can become an officer, either a deck officer or an engineer. Those are licensed mariners, and they are all in the union. The unlicensed mariners are folks sometimes who just have graduated from high school. They get their trainings through unions, and but they're part of a different union group. And they can just, after a little bit of training, walk into a ship and start carrying out orders.
Wow. So how regulated is this industry?
This industry is highly regulated by the U.S. Coast Guard. We have the Marine Act of 1920, which we know as the Jones Act. And the Coast Guard has a huge list of regulations designed to protect mariners and ships and the environment. So it is highly regulated. The problem is executing properly the investigations of these ships and executing properly, of course, oversight of the environmental issues and the human factors involved on these ships because, you know, so much of the time the ships are out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
They're not under our nose,
right.
And the things that happen on these ships sometimes is beyond, you know, beyond our capability of monitoring.
Okay, but it sounds like so far, sort of maybe so good, well-regulated industry, people who are well-trained, trained at least in to some degree, to work on the ship. But you did say that the ship itself was designed in the 60s. What are the implications of that? Like, what advances have been made in shipbuilding and that technology that may not have existed on this particular ship, on El Faro?
Well, at its most basic level, this ship was carrying open lifeboats. The world, the globally, open lifeboats are no longer allowed to be carried on large commercial ships like this anymore. We have enclosed lifeboats, which, if you remember the Yellow Submarine, the Beatles, that little kind of proportionally challenged submarine, that's what enclosed lifeboats look like.
Mm-hmm.
But in America, in the U.S. Merchant Marine, ship hulls that were built before 1986 are allowed to carry the open lifeboats that they were originally built with. So that already created a major problem for the ship, for the people on the ship, because they were they found themselves in a massive hurricane, and they had no chance of escaping that ship safely.
All right, before we get to that hurricane, I want to talk about sort of how it is that a company would allow for that kind of outdated safety situation to exist on the ship. Is it much more expensive to upgrade? The older ships not able to handle those kind of closed escape rafts?
Oh, no. I mean, this ship could absolutely handle the enclosed lifeboats that I'm describing. It's just money. And, you know, by law, they were not required to carry the enclosed lifeboats. And that in itself is a tale that I document pretty thoroughly in the book. But they were not required. It probably would have cost about $500,000 to outfit this ship with a couple of enclosed lifeboats. And that's money. And you know, this is an expensive industry to get into. The ships are not cheap. The insurance is not cheap. There's a lot of overhead. And the margins in shipping are getting smaller and smaller, especially for this Puerto Rican run, where, as you know, following the economic collapse of Puerto Rico, there's been a huge flight to the mainland. So the population is shrinking. The demand for goods is shrinking. And now you have a couple of shipping companies competing for those lucrative Jones Act contracts.
All right. I want to go back to why those profit margins are so narrow, because you would think in an era of globalization that, you know, where goods are making their way across the globe constantly, that there would be a lot of demand for this kind of industry. And why are the profit margins so low?
Quite simply, overcapacity. there are more ships out there than there is cargo to carry. And part of the reason that there's so many ships out there is because many developing countries, including Taiwan and China and Korea, heavily subsidize their shipping industry because they know that exports are what drive their economies. This has a downward effect on American shipping. We try to protect the pricing of American shipping through the Jones Act, but there's always pressure for American shipping companies to keep up with global prices.
All right. So you have what is a fairly routine run twice weekly, as you said, between Florida and Puerto Rico. What went wrong?
When I first started writing this book, the working title for me was How Many Mistakes Does It Take to Sink a Ship, an American Container Ship in 2015? And the answer is almost countless. There were so many things working against this ship and the people aboard. I think one of the major factors, of course, was the fact that this ship was old. She was an accident waiting to happen. But what we learned from the transcript of the black box is that the captain was under incredible pressure to save his job. The shipping companies put a lot of pressure on their shipmasters to deliver goods on time. And those shipping companies, of course, are based on land, and they don't really have a good sense of what's happening out at sea. And so good shipmasters have to balance the demands of commerce with the safety of their crew and cargo.
There was also, obviously, a storm. How big a storm was Hurricane Joaquin, and how is it that they weren't able to avoid it, given, you know, the sort of fairly sophisticated weather forecasting that we have with hurricanes?
Hurricane Joaquin started out as a tropical storm, and the National Hurricane Center had a lot of trouble predicting this one. In fact, it was one of the most poorly forecast storms that we've seen in recent history. Part of that reason is because we have new factors at play that we're not used to dealing with, one of which is the fact that the Atlantic, in that area where the storm kicked up, was 2 degrees warmer than it had ever been. So we had a tropical storm coming through. The fuel of a hurricane is the heat of the water. The tropical storm hits these unusually warm waters of the Atlantic, and it kicks up into a frenzy so quickly that the National Hurricane Center could not keep up. Still, the National Hurricane Center was certain, not certain, but had a certain amount of comfort that this storm would eventually kick north, which most do. They travel up the coast and then dissipate. This one defied all logic and continued on a southwest trajectory, moving very slow, feeding off the impossibly warm waters of the Atlantic at that time of year.
But given all the technology that we have and the constant communications you can have between land and sea in this day and age, how did they not know and prepare for the trajectory once it became clear that it was going in this unexpected direction?
They did know. This is a very interesting part of the story because it's so much about how much we rely on technology, how it gives us a false sense of comfort that we know what's happening. The captain had two weather forecasting services aboard. One was the alphanumeric delivery of the National Hurricane Center. He was getting constant updates about that, but it was just, you know, letters and numbers on a page that came through the ship's dot matrix printer. The other weather forecasting service that he had was called Bon Voyage. This is a beautiful interface. It's something that's very intuitive to use. It shows a map of the area. It shows your ship. It shows your heading, and it shows the storm and the storm's heading. And you can click today, tomorrow, the next day, and see where you will be and see where the storm will be. It gives you this false sense of comfort that we know what will happen. In fact, the Bon Voyage system was based on the National Hurricane Center's information coming out, their forecasts, but it took a while for that company to package the information. So by the time the captain was looking at his beautiful Bon Voyage system and being assured that the hurricane was going to move in a certain way, he was looking at a forecast based on data that had been collected more than 12 hours before. It was garbage data at that point. So he made assumptions based on information that was invalid. And he would not, he refused to acknowledge that the National Hurricane Center eventually was saying something different. He clung to that beautiful interface until the end.
But so you would think there are people on land elsewhere, the owners, the people who they would be talking to, sort of be in constant contact with, others on the ship who would be saying otherwise. Why didn't that, why wasn't that able to override the sort of captain's decision?
You would think that. And this is one of the most shocking things that we discovered through the black box and through the 6 weeks of hearings, is that the shipping company, although it was easy to do, was not tracking that ship. Now, you can do it, and I can do it. There are these websites dedicated to tracking ships all over the world. But the shipping company executives were not. So they had no idea where the ship was at that moment. They assumed she was fine. And they didn't even have awareness of the storm, which was actually the hurricane, which was actually a pretty compact hurricane and did not affect land. On the ship itself, because we have this dialogue from the black box, we know that the mates, the officers, the chief mate, the second mate, the third mate, we know that they understood the gravity of the situation that they were heading for, but they could not convince the captain to let go of his preconceptions about what this storm would do.
So you mentioned there are these black box recordings, and it's a 500-page transcript. Did you listen to the recordings?
The recordings are actually owned by the shipping company, and they did not release them publicly. The National Transportation Safety Board spent 1,000 man hours listening to them and creating this transcript. So it took a tremendous amount of work, and in fact, the audio is quite degraded mm-hmm. as the storm kicks up. But no, unfortunately, I could not listen to those, and neither can the family members, and some of them very much want to.
Does the emotion and terror of that moment, those moments when they're realizing the gravity of the situation, come through in the transcripts?
Oh, absolutely. And what's phenomenal is, like I said, this is 26 hours leading up to the very final moments of the ship. So we have 26 hours of kind of growing doom, fear, and hope among the officers and the helmsmen. Their language is poetic. These are sailors. They're mariners. They've been through all kinds of storms. They tell tales of storms past in very vivid language because they've been through these things before. And they keep reassuring each other when the captain is off the bridge that they'll make it through because, well, we haven't had an accident like this in more than 35 years. How could we lose an American ship? You never think that you will be the one.
What was it like reading these transcripts for you?
It was powerful and horrifying. I first read this transcript all the way through with two mariners, one who had been fired from the company in 2012 and another who had just stepped off that ship a week before her final voyage. He knew everybody on that ship. Mm. It was so emotional and horrifying to read what people were thinking and saying, people who had no idea how the story would end, and we did. It was a very eerie day.
How many people died on the ship, and were there any survivors?
There were 33 people on that ship, and all were lost.
Wow. So you mentioned earlier that there were hearings that followed the disaster. Were those hearings sort of effective? Were they thorough? And what did they conclude?
The hearings, it's important to understand, were to assist the investigation. So these were not criminal proceedings. They were designed so that the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard could both issue reports and then recommendations moving forward about how to address the lessons learned from this particular accident. The hearings were incredible because we got to actually see in person, this is the first time I had really experienced this, the hubris of some of America's executives. I mean, these people had lost a ship and they were clearly blaming the captain and very reluctant to take any of the blame. And that was most evident a month later after the accident when they issued their, when the shipping company issued its usual, report for that month about lessons learned. This is, you know, part of the protocol of shipping. You want to report any findings so that all of your mariners get a little smarter. They did not mention El Faro in that monthly report. So according to Tote, there were no lessons to be learned from the loss of a ship.
Have there been any repercussions in terms of like reforms or anything?
The wheels of justice move slow. Changing laws takes time. The U.S. Coast Guard is charged with regulating the American shipping industry, which means that the American shipping industry is in the biggest stakeholder here. And the Coast Guard does not want to slow the wheels of commerce. So they are very sensitive to the concerns of commercial shippers. And so although there are a number of very important recommendations that came from this investigation and report, it will take a lot of give and take between the Coast Guard and the stakeholders to decide which regulations to change mm-hmm. and which regulations to keep.
If you could argue for one thing to come out of your writing this book and people reading it, what would it be?
There are two major issues here. One, which I mentioned before, are these open lifeboats. They should be banned. I don't know why an older ship is better equipped, if you will, to carry an open lifeboat. It seems counterintuitive to me. We just need to get these open lifeboats off of these ships. In my opinion, they're useless. The other thing that came out of this, which the commercial airline industry learned back in the 70s from the National Transportation Safety Board, is how we communicate in a hierarchical environment. The U.S. Merchant Marine, it's not a division of the armed forces, but it is, you know, you have a commander, and in this case, it's the ship master, and he was God on that ship. Remember, mutiny or insubordination was punishable by death in the 19th century. So you don't challenge your commanding officer. But then we had these very informed mates, other officers, who were trying their best to inform the captain, cajole the captain, professionally beg the captain to reconsider his decision. And that was a communication breakdown. And in that way, this is a very American workplace story with utterly cataclysmic consequences.
Well, it is a hell of a story with huge implications, obviously. Rachel, thank you so much for being here.
Pamela, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The book again is Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Mega Storm, and the Sinking of El Faro by Rachel Slade. Joining us now from London, where she's on book tour, we have Clementine Wamaria. She is the author of The Girl Who Smiled Beads, A Story of War and What Comes After, which she wrote together with Elizabeth Weil. Clementine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book, The Girl Who Smiled Beads, is now a New York Times bestseller, and you've been on tour for about 4 weeks. What's it been like so far having your book out there in the world?
It's been way more exciting than I thought. I was so nervous. I was so nervous for people to hear the truth that I've been carrying with me. Of course, I still tell my family and my friends, but who I was really worried the most were, you know, my closest friends and my family. And everybody has received this story with such a kindness and respect. And for the public, for the general public, everybody's just been really cheering me on, and especially here in the UK. It was really incredible being here and people today just tweeting all day to me mm-hmm. saying how wonderful the book is, that they're going to buy and they're buying for their families. So I'm just really grateful that you know, it's here. It's in everybody's hands.
Speaking of your family and stories and your readers, I want to start with the title of your book, because it's about a story your nanny told you, called The Girl Who Smiled Beads. Can you tell us a little bit about that story? Tell us the story itself.
Yes, The Girl Who Smiled Beads, it's a fairy tale. It's like the Alice in Wonderland of Rwanda. Everybody knows that story. However, the way my nanny put the story was that she would start, and then I'll add on. And every day I added on. And so it's about this woman who longs for a child. And the thunder and the rain gives her this very special child. And once this child is born and begins to smile, she realized that she was very different, very unlike any human she had ever met. When this little baby started, began to smile. When she smiled, gems appeared everywhere. And one day she walked out of her house to be able to experience the world, because her mother had kept her in. And from whichever hill she went, when people looked at her and they realized they did not know her, when they asked her, what's your name, she smiled. And as she smiled, beads appeared everywhere. And whichever hill she went to, people collected the beads. And I always wanted to be that girl when I was little. And that's the imagination that really kept me alive. I mean, besides my sister making sure that I was fed and I was protected, that is how I saw the world. I thought whichever country we went, if I could only smile harder, beads will appear, and my mother will follow the trails of beads I've left behind.
So after fleeing from Rwanda, you and your sister traveled for years through 7 different countries in Africa before you came to the United States when you were 12 years old. But what I like about the title of your book is that it seems to capture a few of the underlying themes of your book and things that sort of run throughout it. So the people collecting the beads, you talk about how while you were traveling, you would collect items as you went along. Can you talk about why you did that and what that gave to you?
You know, I don't remember when I lost the story, but I remember throughout, like, Congo, for example, just right by Lake Tanganyika, that's when I started collecting rocks and shells. And I organized all the rocks because that's how I remembered where we were. You know, this one particular rock was when we were in Vire. This one particular rock was when we were in Kazimia. This one particular rock, that's when we were in Goma, in Tanzania. And this one particular rock. You know, so I kept going, collecting things to be able to remember, because, you know, I was a child. I did not know that I could actually remember things. I always thought that I forget everything. And so that was like the trail that I was making for myself, so that when we decided to go back home, I would know exactly where we had been and the people that I had met.
I'm not sure if I'm reading into this correctly, but The Girl Who Smiled Beads, the story, as you tell it, your nanny encouraged you to add to the story. So it seems like that title is capturing the idea that you were in charge of the story as well, that you were the one who was sort of able to create it, narrate it.
Absolutely. So Claire, she's like the master of like creating possibilities. And for me, is my imagination. And so together, she said, you know, in different parts of a refugee camp, she was like, this is not how people are supposed to live their lives. We need to get out. And she would do everything possible. I mean, she would sell her jewelry, she would sell her clothes. I mean, she would sell anything that anyone can buy so that we can get out of refugee camp. Where for me, you know, later on, I realized in academia, I realized the importance of imagination and how we've abandoned it. And so for me to remember different parts of storytelling, especially the Afro storytelling, such as the one in Rwanda, everybody adds on. Any grown-ups, you go to their house, they could start the story, and then you could go back to their house to exchange. So So you come and dance for them, and they'll give you a story. and so I just really want to introduce a way of storytelling, a way of creating a life that all of us can survive in.
In what ways did that tradition of oral storytelling sort of become infused in the way that you wrote this book?
Everything. I mean, my whole life is add-on.
Mm-hmm.
Add-on and expand-on. And so, you know, someone has fire and I have wood. So let's take together and make firewood and make something to eat. Someone has a spare jacket, and then I have a skirt, and then, you know, we could just change it. We could talk about it and exchange it. And so it's not just only a form of storytelling, but it's also ways of being. And my nanny, like, made sure that she expanded on the people that I met. I write about this particular couple who were farmers, but also who knew the earth so well. I mean, their ideology of Rwanda, it's like the indigenous people of anywhere in the world, really. And they taught me that everything speaks and everything is constantly in communication with me. So, which, you know, as a child, it could be very exciting, but it could be also very scary. But as an adult, I have such a respect. I'm not going to mess with water, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into the woods by myself late at night. You know, I need to respect that the woods needs to sleep at night, you know. And so the way in which I grew up, it was always add on, expand on, and everything and everybody. There's nothing about to diminish the purpose of anything.
The book, The Girl Who Smiled Beads, you also wrote it with a co-writer, with Elizabeth Weil, who
yes.
is a contributing writer here at The Times. How did that work? Was it easier to work with a collaborator? Were you concerned about sort of how much of your own voice would come through? What was that process like?
You know, Elizabeth Weil and I, we created this relationship before we even started writing the book. And the relationship was, she met my family, I met her family, I ate at her house, you know, she ate at my house. That's like the very most Rwandan African thing you can do, is mm-hmm. eat at somebody's house. Her husband cooked for me. And immediately, you know, I got to know her kids, she got to know my sister's kids, who are like very much like my kids. And so we established this sort of, you know, eye-to-eye relationship, and then we spent, hours and hours just having a conversation and getting recorded. And one of the things that I love about our conversation was she would say, well, Clementine, as a mother, and then she would ask me a question. And then she would switch, like, well, as a friend, Clementine, and then she would ask me a question.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, well, as a reporter, here's my other question. And so I had a relationship with her that was, and that is, very honorable. She respects me and I respect her. She respects the oral storytelling of where I come from. I respect her writing skills. And then we had a Maggie, who transcribed hundreds and hundreds of hours of our conversation. And so at this book, you know, I know that there is two of our names, right? But so many people added to this book, and Liz put in 150. And so, and it's even sad that I'm on the road by myself. We finally had a conversation in San Francisco a few days ago, and I said, can we just take this on the road? Can you just, you and me, just go and, you know, just go to bookstores and mm-hmm. speak about what we have done here? So I'm just so grateful for the openness to be able to collaborate in the way we did.
When you got to America for the first time, you were 12 years old. You'd been living in really difficult circumstances, from refugee camp to refugee camp, from country to country, with your sister Claire, who also became a mother herself during this process. You write in your book that by the time you got to America at age 12, that you were already an adult.
Mm-hmm.
How did the American family you lived with in Chicago help you kind of return to childhood?
Well, my mom, Liz, Mama B and Papa B, both are, you know, they've raised three kids before me, so they knew exactly what they were, you know, sort of they thought that they knew what they were doing with me. Mm-hmm. But they were so careful because they just had no idea. They knew what had happened to Rwanda. They knew that I was not with my family anymore. And so they were so careful, so utterly careful. They never asked me, what happened to you? They've never asked me, did this thing happen to you? They just, like, let me be, mm-hmm. which was so respectful. And my mom, I mean, she read with me. You know, I started school at age 13, and so I really needed a lot of help. And one of my favorite things, and I really miss it, is her reading, you know, like few sentences and then allowing me to read a sentence. And it would go back and forth. That's how I learned how to read. My school was maybe like 3 blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
She used to drive me to school and just drop me off to just make sure that I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was one of those things. And also, you know, she was aware that I was not sleeping or having nightmares and things like that. And so she, one of the things that she got me this lavender pillow. And you take it and you put it in the microwave before you go to sleep, and then you put it, you stick it in the big pillow. And so it's like mini pillow and big pillow. She understood my high anxiety in a way that I didn't even know what anxiety was. And then my dad, you know, he's a lawyer, and so everything that I had to do, he's like, well, we need to make sure that it's done by law. And, you know, from, you know, opening a savings account, you know, he took me there to, now you need to save and you need to do tax. And so every part of sort of a young girl trying to understand the world that is so different, they offered everything for me and to me. And my sister, of course, Kali, she was always so protective. Like, if anyone said anything, I mean, her radar was always just there to make sure that no one said anything offensive to me. And if they did, you know, she'd be like, "Was that okay? Was that okay with
mm-hmm.
you?" So I've just been so loved and cared by so many people that once they offered their love too, I took it. Because every country, I always had some type of mother or father figure. And as you read the book, you would understand each person and how they added on to my life.
One of the things I thought was an interesting decision that you made, and I'm curious to hear more about that, is that in America, there's often a very simple narrative that we get around stories of war and devastation and tragedy abroad, which is, you know, terrible things happen in this country, and then the person, you know, managed to get away, and then they came to America, and you know, and then everything sort of ended happily ever after. But you very deliberately said a large part in your story, your book is about what happens when you get to America, that it's not quite that simple.
I mean, it's that whole style of Prince Charming comes and saves you, and then life is good. You know, it's that kind of end of every fairy tale in America. And I really knew that was not the truth, you know, because when you look around, there are real challenges. My sister coming in as, you know, a mother of three and, you know, holding 2-3 jobs. That was not the life that we thought it was going to be, America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going from one neighborhood to another, you see the devastation of what oppression has left, you know, for different kinds of people. You see injustices all around you. And so they painted Hollywood America, that in which many of us outside of America consume. It's not the way it is. And I figured out that very early, especially when we got to Chicago. I figured, I was like, this story right here, it's not true. Let's figure out a way to tell a true story.
What was your impression? What was your sort of conception of America before you got here?
Oh, my goodness. Well, all of it I got from Claire, you know, because, you know, she's so good sometimes at imagining the world where she, you know, survives in and thrives in. And say, you know what? You don't have to work hard. You could just work like a few hours and make so much money. By the way, like within a year, you could buy a car. Within a year, you could buy a house. You know, And, you know, that is like the dream that my sister still have, because, you know, to her, it's like, it is possible. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, it's possible if you are in the categories of the way of being in America of someone who succeeds, the story of someone who succeeds. You know, you go to college, you get a really nice job, you marry somebody, you come together. But the thing is, if you start in America without a bank, that is difficult. If you start in America without, like, a parent, someone to back you up, without a family to back you up, if you're stuck without rent, you become homeless. You know? And so Claire had a painted this picture of, like, basically you could just go and, you know, open a faucet of, you know, somewhere and just get, like, free drinks. I'm like, that's McDonald's and you have to pay some money for that. You can just open a faucet and have some, you know, drink coming out of nowhere. You know, people are like, there's this place where you could just go and grab money. And I'm like, you mean a bank, but you actually have to have money in it. And so there was a whole world painted where, you know, and also like just watching movies, you know, like watching, you know, some particular movies. I thought some part of it was really violent. I mean, I remember watching one of those, Arnold Schwarzenegger, that movie that he's in where he's just shooting, and I was like, I don't want to go there. The Terminator. Oh my goodness. I remember watching Terminator and saying, is this the America that I'm going to go to? Because I really don't want to go. I really don't want to go at all. And my sister's like, no, that is just a movie. And I'm like, well, are you sure about that? Because the other movies say that everything's really amazing too. And so, and also, I'm just so, I'm grateful. I'm not complaining. I'm just being a realist. Like, there are real things, and I want people to know that when you come to America, just like anywhere in the world, it's going to be very difficult to start out with nothing. Many people have land, you know, mm-hmm. in their home country, and then they leave and they think they're coming to America. They will have a land right away, and they'll build a house, you know, but that's not true, you know. It requires so much money to be able to own a land, to be able to own a home. You're forever tied to rent. Like, many people who you see fleeing their country, they've never paid rent.
Mm-hmm.
They always lived in their homes. And they're like grandparents' homes. Like, they have land.
What most surprised you when you got here about America?
How much wasteful in terms of food there is. I just could not believe the waste. I still, like, I've been in America for 17 years. I still do not understand the wasteful of food and just bunch of resources that people beg. I've not even beg. They would do anything to have, you know, and I'm not even talking about, like, only food, but just like clothes and things like that, things that people would. And so for me, I have never gone over the whole food, you know, waste of food, people throwing food, restaurants throwing food. I mean, I get so anxious about it even till today.
When you talk about the challenges and that your sister had and that you had coming to this country, you went on to do very well in high school. You went then to Hotchkiss and on to Yale. That's just an amazing achievement. Like, what qualities do you think that you had that kind of enabled you to succeed in that way after such a difficult childhood?
Well, I'm hungry to be able to, you know, enlighten people to think beyond themselves, to think beyond other people, you know, to just think that we are all here on Earth together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all come from Earth. We all come from a womb. And that, for me, I knew that. I knew that we all belong here. You know, my mother reminding me, Turawa Narimana, we're children of all Creator. Creator of all things, the seen and unseen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always had that in my head. And so I thought that if I went to high school and college, I would be able to convey that message better. Maybe people will have a respect for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so education has been a tool to be able to communicate the passion that I've had since as a child, and the wisdom that my mother encouraged in all of us, all of our family. And so that is what really set me apart. Another thing, I had people who just shared all their resources. Someone just sharing their skill of tutor, you know, being a tutor. She, you know, Marianne came and taught me how to count in English, taught me ABC, taught me, you know, this is Apple, this is a house, this is this, you know. Michelle Becker, who came and said, I want to make sure that Clementine gets the best of everything in school. Let's make sure that she has an extra ASL class. You know, my American parents opening up their home, they're saying, we have a bed upstairs, it's empty, we want to put you so you could be comfortable and sleep. You know, someone saying, hey, you're going to need some self, you know, sort of confidence as a woman, as a young woman, changing, the body's changing. I want to take you shopping and teach you how your body, how to carry your body, mm-hmm. how to be in your body. And so I've had everything, and I've had everybody. And so, and the conclusion is that really, I know the gift of sharing and the freedom of sharing. And I am also that person who's received the true love of sharing. And so that's what I've always known as a child.
What is it that you hope to share with readers in having this story, your story, come out as a book? What is it that you would like, ideally, for readers to come away with?
You know, there's just so much. But, you know, one thing that I really want the readers to take away, it's on, you know, I would love to read it to you. It's on page in the book on 177, where I say, and, you know, true survival of the body and the soul, and I'll even add the spirit, requires creativity, freedom of thoughts, and collaboration. You might have time and I might have land. You might have idea and I might have strength. You might have a tomato and I might have an eye. We need each other. We need to say, I honor the things that you respect. And I value the things that you cherish. I'm not better than you. You're not better than me. Nobody is better than anybody else. And nobody is who you think they are at first glance. We need to see beyond the projection we cast into each other. And really, that projection, is the way we put ourselves into teen cubbies based on race and class, ethnicity, religion, anything really. For me, I think that's a poverty of mind and a poverty of imagination. And so I'm just encouraging people to look deep into their experiences and just their daily lives and say, what is it that I am beyond labels? What is it that I am in my heartbeat? Who am I in my breath? And then look around you and think that everybody's thinking the same way. And if they're not, ask them that question. Who are they?
Well, that's a very powerful message to end on. Clementine, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me.
Clementine Wamaria is the author of The Girl Who Smiled Beads, A Story of War and What Comes After, already a best-selling author. So again, Clementine, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Joining us now, our three critics, Dwight Garner, Paul Siegel, and Jen Salai. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Well, let's start off with the latest news this week, actually, Tom Wolfe's death. Dwight, you wrote an appraisal.
I did, and I was so sorry to hear about his death. I mean, he's a writer who sort of meant a lot to me. When young, I wanted to be a journalist, and the kind of journalist I wanted to be was a new journalist. Of course, who wants to be an old journalist when you're young? But and thanks to Tom Wolfe's anthology, The New Journalism, in which he packaged a lot of writers who weren't really, they didn't quite belong together. I mean, Joan Didion was in there. She's not exactly a new journalist, but it was filled with these terrific voices, and people like Hunter S. Thompson and Jimmy Breslin, who's a slightly older generation. But, you know, Wolf's Sentences just blew your body back a foot or two. And as I say in my piece, it wasn't just that his style was unique, which it certainly was, but just he had just this, I hate the word gimlet, I'm going to say it anyway, a gimlet eye for just class and society. And when he described you, you were described. I mean, he had a NORAD kind of vision for just nailing things. And so he just, terrific. And reading books like The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test about the bus and Ken Kesey, so different from his pieces about, say, Leonard Bernstein and Mau Mauing the Flag Catchers, he could do almost anything. And then going to NASA and writing one of the great histories of NASA. I mean, here was,
the right stuff.
You know, here was a writer in full, even before we get to the fiction.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't start on fiction until he was in his late 50s.
Yes. And he tried, you know, famously and problematically. He self-consciously modeled himself after writers like Zola, who wanted to bring the whole world into his books, all of society, not just write from his own perspective. And, you know, to a large degree, he pulled it off. There are many people, including Harold Bloom, who would take Bonfire of the Vanities over John Updike's best work. I happen to not agree with that, but I think Bonfire is a terrific piece of fiction. And his later novels, less so, but he just had a lot of energy.
Well, he tried to kind of do like the novel of the decade, right? Bonfire of the Vanities was the 80s. A Man in Full was at least trying to be the 90s. And then...
Which is always sort of a mistake, you know, to try to self-consciously
to
write the novel.
Decade.
Yeah. He had that, hubris. He had a pretty massive ego and tried to do a lot. And, you know, he didn't always write great books, but there was always great stuff in them and he achieved a lot.
I remember the first time I encountered him was when I was working at a B. Dalton in the late 80s, and Bonfire of the Vanities came out in hardcover. And it was such an audacious looking paperback. And I don't know if you remember like the cover art from it, but it was just like bright and loud and felt monumental. And those were the days, back in the great glory days when chain bookstores would offer order just massive quantities of the big books.
Pamela, we have to share our B. Dalton memories at some point.
Oh my God.
Because I worked at all the, I worked for B. Dalton and, oh, there's another one that was in all
Walden
the malls.
Books.
Walden Books. I worked for all these places. In my era, the big paperback was World According to Garp, which came in 1,000 different colors. Anyway, someday on this podcast, we will share our
Actually, we should have a whole other World According to Garp, John Irving conversation. Bonfire, there were these amazing, I'm sure you remember these sort of magisterial swirling towers that they would create in the stores that were beautifully assembled. And, you know, you felt terrible if you so much as knocked into the top, you know, one or two, and then there was no way to get it back to that kind of.
You didn't have to build them, did you?
No, we weren't allowed to build them. I was like a lower staff
they brought in
member.
Specialists
yeah, there were
in the
people that
office.
Were, that's right. That's right. But to me, that felt like the grown-up world. And I remember reading it, and that was also the era of Spy magazine, and thinking, like, this is New York. This is what the world is actually like, you know. And I think around that same time, went to see a Madonna concert in the Meadowlands at the Meadowlands in New Jersey.
This story's getting better and better, by the way.
What I'm trying to say is here, I guess you started to see the world through the lens of Tom Wolfe. At least I did growing up in New York. And I remember we got off, I was with my best friend and we were in a fight. We got off at the wrong exit and ended up in the Bronx. And that entire experience of sort of being lost in the Bronx, was Tom Wolfe. You know, we like expected the squeegee men and the, you know, everything that ensues because Tom Wolfe had written it.
So question, what do you think is going to last of his work?
Yes. I think several of the books. Think people are going to be reading The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test for as long as people are reading books. Mm-hmm. Bonfire, I think, it's such a joyride and it's mm-hmm. so smart. And I don't see that going out of print anytime soon. After that,
I mean, what's amazing about Bonfire, too, just to dwell on that for one more moment, is that it's kind of now also, you know, there were all these characters. I mean, I think someone said online that he wrote about Trump before Trump existed,
right,
and that's
right.
really true. But like the social x-rays, all those women, some of them are still around and you see them, and it's just impossible, again, to like divorce their sort of current, what you see from what Tom Wolfe saw, because it was so, I mean, I think in your... in your appraisal, Dwight, you listed some of the phrases that he coined, and I think that's what lasts too, which is maybe
I was
more
shocked
about his
when
journalism.
I saw that. I think Ben Zimmer did something at The Atlantic too, which is just sort of this lexicon of language we unthinkingly use came from this one person. And they just trace like how many contributions he has in the OED and things like that. Like, that's very true.
Like,
Master of the Universe, all of this stuff.
Yeah, social x-rays, what else?
The me decade, yeah. Pushing the envelope.
Pushing the envelope. Like, I felt like that's
good old boy. Who knew he had good old boy, too?
Wow.
Pushing the envelope, you were saying?
I was going to say, it just feels like something that existed always. Like, how
I agree.
Did someone even...
And there were other ones that can bleep. I think screwing the pooch was, you know, from the NASA book. There were a lot of them.
Do you think his journalism was sort of his greater achievement?
I do, certainly. Yeah. You know, there was this whole world of, you know, the last great era, in a way, of American journalists was his era, in a way, before, you know, before the internet came along and stole everyone's thunder. There was this enormous competition in the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s to do something really different with journalism. And it was sort of like this mass of wriggling competitors. And mm-hmm. he just stepped right across the top of them, you know, and just wrote the best journalism of that time.
And it was such an era for magazines, too, right? He had a close association with Esquire. Bonfire was excerpted serially,
ran serially in Rolling Stone.
You would see that banner on the top of each issue and think, you know, it seemed to go on forever, too.
It did. And he didn't, you know, I remember trying to read it, not really caring that much at the time. I was just like, oh, here's this filling up my issue again. Please give me some more Bruce Springsteen articles, you know. But he edited quite a lot after that. After it ran, it got better.
What do we mean by the new journalism? What did Tom Wolfe do to journalism?
Well, it's complicated, but essentially part of it was writing, the easiest part perhaps was most of those writers wrote in the present tense. They brought in novelistic techniques like scene setting. They would interview so many people that they could get a kind of surround sound sense of what happened in a certain room and give it to you as if it were happening live. And of course, some writers overstepped that boundary. And, you know, we may well find that Wolfe did sometimes as well. I mean, you have to read his books give him a certain amount of license to set these scenes. But I think a lot of the things he did then, which seemed radical, are just run-of-the-mill now.
Pearl, you wrote about a collection from a very different kind
That's
of writer,
right.
Also prolific, Jim Holt.
Right. But a writer who's also trying to put his own stamp on a certain kind of writings. Jim Holt, I mean, I don't even know how you describe Jim Holt. I guess he's a science writer. I suppose he's a philosopher. He's kind of one of those Edwardian hobbyists. Like, he just knows a little bit about everything, and he brings his love of jokes and poetry and cosmology into these profiles that have been collected in this book, essays from the last 20 years, some of which sort of dilate on particular points of contention, string theory, et cetera, et cetera. But most of them really do seem animated by love of these peculiar men, and it is book. It's a book mostly about men, with one exception. But yeah, his love for the sort of desire to understand the world, to create these sort of, going back to Wolfe, these incredibly huge, baggy theories of the universe, and marrying it to like, well, who are you? What happened to you? What made you so curious in this particular way? You know. Mm-hmm. And I just loved it. I mean, I loved Jim Holt. He wrote a beautiful book a few years ago called Why Does the World Exist? You know, anytime he writes anything, you know, he reviews a lot for the book review. Anytime he does anything, I kind of just want to know what he thinks. I just like his mind. And I like his ability to make these things that can seem so abstruse and complicated, intelligible to me. You know, I mean, speaking of people that are sort of like passionate about these things, but don't have much grounding, you know, so yeah, I mean, it's great fun. I've been pushing his books on people who haven't read much science and don't think that it's for them, and especially people who think that mathematics is something, you know, very elitist. And
Where do these pieces appear originally?
Most of them seem to have been in the New Yorker and the New York Review of Books.
Okay.
And yeah, he's really very interestingly consistent. I think that's one of those things when you're reading essay collections over 20 years. Like, how have you changed? Can I spot the ones when you were younger and now? No, he really seems to have found very early on a language, a very conversational tone, a way of structuring these pieces. And they move very fluidly. So yeah, especially if you're somebody who thinks that, you know, you keep hearing pure mathematics as being described as beautiful and elegant, and you have no idea what this means. Like, do pick up this book. It's really, you know, a good introduction to what, you know, the sort of loveliness of this human achievement, which he kind of describes as like, it's almost like a mountain. It's like, it's in the world. It's in your interest to look at it. It's in your interest to sort of enjoy it. So it's very friendly. A lot of fun.
And accessible, it sounds like.
Very accessible.
All right. The theme here is men and books about men.
That's
because,
a new one.
Jen, you also reviewed a book by a man.
A man, yes.
And a very manly man, I guess, in certain ways.
Yes. So John McCain's newest book, which is called The Restless Wave, and it's a book that he co-wrote, again, with Mark Salter, with whom he's co-written numerous other books. And, you know, as McCain makes very clear in this book, you know, he received a diagnosis of brain cancer last year. And so he's not sure if this will be his last. The way that the book is written and the way that it's structured and the way that it ends, it really ends on sort of a valedictory note in a way. He does present this book as sort of the last words that he wants to get out to the American public.
So he is not an unknown quantity. Even though he can be kind of contradictory.
Yes. To say the least.
Okay. So let's talk about both those things. First, I guess the first is, did you feel like you got a kind of new vision of the person, a new understanding from reading this book? Or does it feel kind of like this is the John McCain that we all know?
Well, I mean, I think that there's several John McCains that we know, and I don't mean that necessarily as, you know, this scathing criticism. I mean, I think like any politician, he's adjusted his positions over the years, and he's had a very long political career. I mean, he's in his sixth term as an Arizona senator. So, and then before that, he was in the House of Representatives. And, you know, so over that time, you know, the country has changed too, and he's adjusted his positions. If you talk to some of his critics, they'll say he's adjusted his positions opportunistically. If you talk to other people, they'll say he's adjusted his positions because he has truly changed his mind. And, you know, he does get a little bit into that in this book. And, this book very much is looking for the most part on the past. I mean, he wants to talk about certain issues that are very important to him. Clearly, foreign affairs is a big one. So there are several chapters that are really devoted to what's happening outside the country. He does have some on what's going on right now in the United States. And he does talk a little bit about his role in the Republican attempt to repeal Obamacare. So there's a little bit of that. But for the most part, he wants, and the subtitle, I can't remember the exact wording, but part of it is about appreciation and good fights, I think, is one of the things in the subtitle. And he really wants to look back on that and remember, I think.
I mean, it's interesting for someone who was for so long considered a maverick, a contrarian, someone who would say anything. It sounds like the book is pretty safe and that there aren't any major revelations or risks there.
That was my assessment. You know, I mean, I think, you know, I did mention at one point he does say that the Iraq War, which he was in favor of from the very beginning through the surge, that he does say that we need to judge it as a mistake, but he also says that he doesn't regret his support for it. So it's kind of an interesting, I mean, he's trying to sort of thread.
Wait, was this written by a politician?
Right, exactly. So I think that that's the other thing about McCain, where, you know, for, as you pointed out, I mean, this sort of maverick persona has been something that people sort of, it sort of sticks in the public mind. But, you know, at the same time, he has been a politician. And in this book, he does talk a lot about seeking consensus, I think partly because of the current moment that we're living in. I mean, in a way, you know, one of his defenders could probably say, well, that's part of being a maverick, that when times are just so crazy, and when everyone is sort of an extreme maverick, here you have somebody who's playing the role of level-headed.
Level-headed maverick.
Level-headed statesman.
Layers on maverick.
Exactly.
Does he mention Sarah Palin?
Yes, he mentions her. He says that, you know, he really at the time, and this came out at the time too in 2008, that he wanted to pick Joe Lieberman as his running mate, but because of the mood in the country, he felt that ultimately Palin would be the right choice. And he doesn't seem to be that regretful.
Mm-hmm. So interesting, because so much of what people attribute to him is leadership, and yet that sounds like a very sort of responsive to political concerns.
Well, and I think he's always sort of walked this line. I think it's really interesting to see different, to also read different perspectives on him, because I think people looking at the same information come to totally different conclusions of what his motivations are. But yes, and he does make clear in this book, I mean, that also is maybe one of the interesting things in this book, but he does do this in some of his previous books too, where he does sort of walk the reader through why he made the decisions he made. And so he does, you know, walk the reader through why he decided to go with Palin. And he's very complimentary about her. I mean, he really thinks that she did very well in her debate with Joe Biden.
This all sounds very disappointing to me.
Yes, I think it's, and that's one of the things that was sort of, when it came to reviewing the book, one of the tough things was that he does make very clear in this book that because of his medical prognosis, that he does feel freer to be even more candid.
Right.
Yet when it comes down to
he's
it,
he's really careful.
He's pretty careful. I mean, he will say, there's a lot of sort of lamenting of, you know, the rancor in the country and how everybody seems so divided. But that's more general. Right. That's you know, when it comes down to it, he's, you know, he says that he's cautiously hopeful that President Trump will eventually sort of understand the moral obligations of America's role in the world. I mean, there's a lot of that kind of, there's still a lot of politicking in this book, which is also sort of an interesting choice.
Old
on
habits.
His part. Yeah. I mean, you know, and at the same time, I think it's important to remember that, you know, he is a military guy. I mean, that experience in Vietnam, being held as a POW for 5.5 years, being tortured, but also refusing early release. I mean, he was offered early release by the Vietnamese once they found out that his father was a big deal in the Navy. And he refused early release because there's a code in the Navy that you don't get released before other people who were taken prisoner ahead of you, because that would be seen as giving taking special favors from the enemy. And so he does... As a military guy, I do think, or I do wonder, I guess, because I'm not totally sure, but if also part of this is, you know, for him, the Republicans, those are his guys. Yeah. Those, that's his team. Those are his guys. He really wants to believe that ultimately the country can come together to sort of play this important role in the world and be united.
So it's functioning with like some kind of code.
Yes, know, that there's a... I sense some of that in this book.
Have any of you ever gone and watched the footage of him when he was a prisoner of war?
No.
Oh, it's amazing. And there's this amazing documentary that came out about 20 years ago called Return with Honor that featured John McCain along with a few other POWs at the time that had this amazing footage in it. And if you read the detail, I mean, when he, you know, crashed, he broke, I think, both arms and both legs. And they took his arms and they deliberately bent back both of his broken arms. And there is a statue in Vietnam of him, you know, and not McCain, but another one of the prisoners of war that he was with at that time. They, you know, interviewed them all on camera and sent it back as kind of propaganda. And one of them was blinking out the words torture in Morse code. During his, and there was another one where, you know, they were able to write some letters back, and I think this was, it wasn't McCain, but another one who said, because they were heavily censored, but in ostensibly writing about the weather, he said something like, "The weather here is fine, but it's dark at noon."
Wow,
this documentary is worth watching, and it's interesting because every time, you know, I would sort of see those different contradictory parts of McCain, some things maybe more admirable than others. I sort of remind myself of that footage.
Well, and I think that, you know, if you go back to David Foster Wallace wrote this very long Rolling Stone profile of McCain in 2000, where when McCain was vying for the Republican nomination, and Wallace really goes back. I mean, he keeps going back in the essay to what happened to McCain in Vietnam, because, you know, one of the sort of overarching themes of the piece that Wallace says he's trying to get at is this idea of authenticity and what's real in a politician. Because, you know, also this is the sort of the tail end of Clintonian centrist triangulation. So this is like a very different moment in American history, especially compared to now. And I think for Wallace, there was something about McCain's experience where when he was trying to imagine, and he's, you know, he tells the reader to try to imagine that you're in this situation, you're in this box, but you refuse to give up because of this idea of the code, essentially. And you could, you know, for Wallace, that really was very, not only interesting, but also very appealing. And, you know, he does have things in the profile about, you know, McCain's very conservative voting record and his policies and, you know, being extremely anti-abortion and all these things that Wallace took issue with. But at the same time, this idea of the authentic politician was so powerful for him.
All right. Well, I guess the theme is, in part at least, maybe two out of three legacies. So thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.